Welcome back to another episode of Hodinkee Radio. Today's episode of the show is sponsored by our friends at Brooklady, the award-winning whiskey from Islay, who we have partnered with here at Hodinkee for the last couple of years. Stay tuned for an update later in the show on what we're up to this season. Hello and welcome to another Hodinkee Radio episode. It's actually our last episode of the year and the fourth in our year-end series. So we did two looking back at 2024. We did two looking forward to 2025. I've already recorded and you'll be able to see the one with Malaika and Tantan. Check that out on YouTube or certainly on the site. But check out the previous episodes for sure. And now we've got the final episode of the year and I've got editor and photographer Mark Kozlerich and editor Rich Forden joining me today to chat all about kind of what we think of 2025, what we're excited about, what we're kind of concerned about, where we think things are going. Guys, you know, we spent the last episode with you two really chatting about what it looked like the trends had been for the last year. I'm interested in what your sort of predictions are, even at sort of a broad level, if there's something from this year that you think won't work next year, something we'll see more of next year, if there's a play that feels... You know, I feel like the playbook for the last several years has been vintage-inspired design for a lot of watch brands. Does that playbook still feel relevant? Do we think there's a new one? Where do you guys land on this? Maybe, Rich, you want to take it away?
Yeah, thanks, James. I had lots of questions in there. I think the topic on vintage re-releases or inspiration. We're seeing things that have a bit of vintage inspiration already, but are moving things forward. I think the industry as a whole is lacking in new designs, and some of the smaller brands are coming in with vintage inspired things that feel very, very new. So it doesn't have to be like an RM or some crazy Hublot to be a new, fresh design to the watch world. I mean, there's a lot of like open space to run in when you look at watches. So
right.
I would expect continual tying to heritage product with brand story and product story, but offering something that's truly different and trying to move things forward, which I think the watch world could use a lot of.
How about you, Mark? What do you think? You feel similar?
Yeah, I mean, you asked what I was concerned about. I don't know that we have enough time for that, and I don't know that it's on topic for this podcast. But
hey,
it's the
end of the year. This could also just be the airing of the grievances.
Let's just get into it now.
he lights a cigarette.
I have similar sort of general concerns. I don't know that Rich framed them as concerns, but like there's so much repetition and. You know, I think a lot of people might be surprised at the number of, cold emails and pitches and messages to my Instagram and messages to my personal email, which I specifically, the only place it's listed, I specifically say, don't send watch pitches to this email, but people still do it anyway. And I would say like 80% of them look the same. It's hard to imagine that when we see things like Burneron or other brands coming out with creative things. And I think that's great and necessary, but it's so hard because you don't want to be mean to people that are trying really hard and doing something new, but it's hard for me to sit and look at somebody and find a way to say like your dive watch that looks like everybody else's dive watch isn't maybe necessarily the thing that the market needs right now or might not be successful. I do have a concern as we talk about like the trends of the market economically and a lot of like hemming and hawing about downtrends and prices going down. I'm a little worried about how many micro brands, smaller brands like this, brands that aren't bringing something unique to the table will survive in 2025. So not to start out or end the year on a depressing note, but that's something that I've been thinking about for a while.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting concern. And I think there's a couple examples here of like things that I predicted years ago that, of course, I was just like dead wrong. I thought that we would have been totally tired by the vintage trend now. And instead, we have a major brand relaunching Universal Genève. Clearly, we're not tired of this as a whole. Maybe it works better with UG because they straddle the line with some sporty elements, but very dressy as well versus, you know, a purely sort of mid-century sport watch brand. And then at the same time, I think I also said that, yeah, probably 2018, 2019, I thought it was going to be a pretty tough time out there for micro brands, especially those in the, you know, the budget categories, the Kickstarter brands, things like that. And it feels like they've also enjoyed quite a bump in the resulting years from the increase in attention during the pandemic, but then also into what we've seen post-pandemic with kind of a lot of price sensitivity, bringing more focus to these brands that are able to make a watch that people can be excited about for $1,500 or less, something like that.
Yeah, now that price sort of that price point has moved up a little bit. I think, you know, it is harder to keep things under $1,500. We were talking about this for year end recaps. You know, give me a couple extra $100 and I can find something pretty good. But that budget mark is harder to meet. I have a question for Rich, actually, as somebody that pays attention to the vintage market, secondary market, these sort of revival brands and stuff. I assume that 2025 will finally be the year of Urban Jorgensen. We've been waiting for a while. We missed, I think, the 250th anniversary. I still see a lot of them come up for market, a lot of dealers asking about them. Kirill posting Urban Jorgensen all the time. A Collected Man just posted one. Is that a sign that there's still demand? Is it people trying to get ahead of hype by like gathering resources and holding on to them? Or do you think Urban Jorgensen is going to actually have like a pretty successful launch when it happens?
Yeah, I think it gets into a topic of like how brands are doing relaunches or Urban Jorgensen is a vintage inspired brand whenever Kari decides to come out with it, which you will never hold him to a date, as we've learned. But what I like to think of for vintage inspired brands, and this gets into UG as well, is that like the Longines playbook from 2014, 2015 is been played and does not work anymore. Like they did a great job. They're probably the best big brand to bring back a heritage line that was super inspired by things and make it a little bit bigger, make it wearable, make it palatable to their customer, which is a more consumer level customer, but also draw in the attention from enthusiasts who maybe can't find that vintage thing or think it's a bit too small. I think that playbook's done. I don't want UG to do that playbook. Nobody does, but it's still a very, very fine line to walk. We'll see what UG does, obviously. They've already done one watch, which is in very low quantities, which is more of that one-to-one playbook. But I understand that's not the direction going forward, which I'm glad to hear. You know, I'd rather you see that name be used as something to move watches forward with a great heritage to tie to, rather than just say, you don't want to go on eBay and buy a UG, you can walk into a store now. How about that? Like, I don't want that. Nobody wants that. On the Urban Jorgensen topic, you know, interest is still growing. Rose Gold Reference 3 just did, I think, 65 at Phillips or Sotheby's in New York, which is a really good number for that watch. I think that's the number they should sit at. It's a perpetual calendar. It's really, really amazingly finished from the dial, hands, and case perspective. But I think there's a bit of speculation going on. The interesting thing about Urban Jorgensen to me is the man that owned or was very involved in the brand, he didn't own it, Peter Baumgartner did, but his best friend was Dr. Helmut Kropp, who is still very active in the watch scene. I was in Geneva. The first night I was there, I was shown by someone who actually works for A Collected Man, what was told to me as a unique white gold Reference 3, which is when you find them in white metal, it's most often platinum. And he was showing it to a couple of people around this party I was at. And I was like, that's really cool. I wrote a whole story about Reference 2s and 3s. Never saw one in white gold before. Ran into Helmut Kropp the next night. And he's like, oh yeah, we made like 10, 15 of those. I don't remember exactly how many, but definitely not unique. So it's interesting when vintage collecting gets this point of like, whenever we think about truths in vintage collecting, it's always like in this distant past, which you can never know. It's almost like archaeology. But with Urban Jorgensen, the guy who bought the back stock and all the archives is like still around. So you can ask him, which I think actually can kind of hurt a brand when information is super set in stone like that. Or, you know, whether he's willing to give it or not, it was just to me in conversation. He might not even like me sharing it here. But as a collecting sort of community, I think it's better for the market when things are a bit more like Rolex than they are Patek, where it's like, yeah, you know, this case and this dial come from the same year. Let's accept that that's correct. Whereas Patek, it's like, if it's not on the extract, that's not your dial, which Urban Jorgensen, should it sort of mature a ton, that style of collecting is probably more towards the Patek side of things, where we know what the watches were when they were first made. When I look at Kari's relaunch, I tried to get information out of him when I wrote that article. I think it was about a year ago.
I've tried many times, so don't worry that you didn't get much.
Even so much as like, are you going to use the same lugs, which are very unique on Urban Jurgensen's from the 90s that I love so much? Like they're very small, like turtle lugs, but super, super tiny teardrops. And he was like, yeah, I won't even say that much. So, I mean, we'll see the direction. The guilloche dials that were in Urban Jurgensen made by Derek Pratt and his team probably will be carried through to Kari's iteration because that's, you know, also his specialty. But beyond that, I'm just waiting and seeing, and I'm not setting a calendar reminder for that one. We'll see.
Again, special thanks to our partners at Brooklady for the support of Hodinkee Radio. This holiday season, we've partnered with Brooklady on a special giveaway that you can learn all about in the link in the article below or in the notes for this episode. You might be surprised at what you see, and you most definitely don't want to miss it. And now, back to the show. One thing that we touched on while getting into the Urban Jurgensen line there was pricing of watches these days. Do you guys think that there's a pricing problem? We definitely see it in the comments where pretty much any watch comes out at almost any price. And the pushback is like, hey, I'm interested in this, but like, why this number? And there's a new level of price sensitivity that comes from the level of inflation and other things we've been experiencing outside of just watch pricing. But I think it also has an effect on watch pricing. And I think that in many ways, it feels as though pricing has kind of outstripped the normal kind of growth that pricing can go through over a period of time. Where do you guys land on pricing? Because value still feels okay. But there's definitely examples of stuff that feel real spicy.
It's tough to say because there's one watch in particular that I talk about a ton. Every time I look at their website, it seems like, yep, we can get an extra $500 out of you. We can get another $500 out of you. And I look away for 2 seconds. I come back and it's $500 more. And that's not really how it is. But when you set in your mind, like, oh, this was good at, you know, 10,100, and then it's 10,500, and then it's 11,000 the last time I looked at this watch, and it's the SLGW003, the manual line Grand Seiko. That's crept up.
Yeah.
And it literally just came out this year. So I was a little surprised at that. But then there's also, I think the hardest thing maybe for some people, first of all, like understanding that your frame of reference for what a watch is worth is formed when you start looking at that watch. And maybe if the watch or that framework of watches, whether it's Speedmasters, have been out for ages, and some people have been looking at Speedmasters for 10 years and thinking, oh, you know, a Speedmaster should be X price, and now it's X plus $2,000 or $3,000. You're going to feel that hit for the pricing a lot more. And then the other side of it too is when you compare against other people on the market or even within the brand, I think it becomes very easy to become very price sensitive and a little surprised. I mentioned maybe to you, James, the other day, but I was going through the Rolex catalog and I did not realize that there's only like a $600 delta between a date Submariner and a GMT. And yep. That starts to feel a little strange as well. Like, shouldn't the GMT be significantly more complicated? Shouldn't it be, I don't know if it's a GMT should feel more expensive or a Submariner should feel more like a more entry-level budget option or something like that, a little more value in there. But
okay,
I think people are paying a lot of attention to all of those little things, and any little movement, any little thing that you can pick up on in terms of pricing feels really big lately.
We're also just seeing new watches come out at what feels like more than they would have come out at just a couple of years ago. So it's not just the progressive percentage added onto a line of successfully working watches. It's like new watches come out and you go like, well, okay, I guess that's the price. Like
the Speedmaster that I wrote about, the Pilot Speedmaster, I think people were sort of surprised at the price on that. And it's sort of what I was alluding to when you're used to a Speedmaster of some sort being worth, you know, maybe say under $8,000, and a new one comes out and all of a sudden it's significantly more than that, even though there's nothing, you know, that you can do a direct one-to-one correlation for a new model. Even if there's small changes, like mechanical, this one's an automatic, it has 100 meters of water resistance or whatever, but you've sort of already framed your expectation of what a a Speedmaster can be. And even though those have now crept up over $8,000, you know, something that's getting closer to 10 just feels really sort of outside what you're used to, whether or not it's a good value for the specs or whatever.
Yeah. Rich, what do you figure?
Yeah, I think on the modern watch side, obviously, is what we're talking about here, where the brands let me down a lot of times is that I do not think that these large modern brands are hurting for margin. So yes, you can give them excuses of inflation, costs being higher, and they just pass those right on to consumers without wanting to, I mean, with wanting to sort of maintain their previous margins, which we don't know for a lot of brands, but I know they're very healthy, right? Like, I would like to see a bit more respect of price bands by the brands to not push themselves out of something just because costs are rising given macroeconomic factors. I can come to this question from, like, I used to work on the shop side and be more on the merchandising and buying side. And I can give credit to a former colleague, Saori Omura here. She was a master at pricing when we did our vintage drops. And we would have conversations all the time of, this is a great watch. It has to be under seven, because once you creep over seven, even if it's $7,200 that you're asking someone to spend $10,000. You know, there's certain barriers in watch pricing where it starts to become feeling like you're spending more. And if you keep it under those barriers, it feels like you're spending less. For example, like 38 is way closer to spending $3,000 than it is to spending $5,000 mentally, even though you're spending $5,000. Like, after tax, after everything, there are these certain, and excuse me if I'm getting a bit too high-minded, but we used to think about it a lot, is like, what is the psychological process of somebody clicking that buy button? And if we can move the price a couple hundred dollars and make someone feel a lot better about their purchase, then that's not a return. That's also a happy customer. You know, like, there are certain things that you can do specifically on the, we would do that work on the buy side with the seller and say, hey, can we knock $100 off this price? We want to keep it under here so it sells quickly and we have a happy customer. Brands can do that too, where they say, we're going to give up $100, $200 of margin to make our customer feel a bit better by keeping it a speedy, what is it, under $7,000 instead of a little bit over. Like, that's a big barrier. Am I right there? I think the last time I checked speedy pricing, but
plus or minus $1,000, I think. But
yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the same psychology can apply to the difference between 7 and 8. Sure. You know, those, especially when you're under $10,000, it's very, very sensitive, even a couple $100. And I would like to see brands respect that further. I don't think they need to. I don't think they will, but I'll just call it out and say something I wish they cared more about.
No, I like the position of, like, making the recommendation, essentially. Like, you this is something people should be focusing on. I just think, you know, there's eras. Everything's a push and a pull, right? The swing of the pendulum. And there's eras where price sensitivity is very low, 2021, 2022. And there's eras where it's quite high. And I think, you know, a lot of us can remember even like 2015, 2014, we saw a lot of kind of adjustments to the market in terms of pricing and that sort of thing. And I'm definitely curious to continue on this trend of, like, how we might approach these sorts of things. So, like, just for fun, for 2025, you're going to be, and we've got a handful of brands, I've got on a list here, the CEO of a brand. What would you do to kind of, like, fine tune something that feels like it would be a good move for 2025? Why don't we kick it off with, like, a brand that absolutely crushed it in 24 with Tudor? If you guys were going to be in charge of Tudor for the year or whatever, would you just carry on the same? Is it more Formula One? Is it less Formula One? Is it more Pelagos, which has definitely been in the playbook for the last year? Or is it less now that that line's quite broad? What do you guys think?
I have some hopes. And Tudor's an interesting one because I feel like every once in a while they give you exactly what you want. I think the Black Bay monochrome was kind of that. And it was sort of proof that it's okay for them to run into Rolex a little bit. I think there's been some skittishness the last few years of Tudor being like, we don't want to come too close to giving you a perfect version of the Rolex you can't get. So let's give you something that has a little bit of oddity or variety. We still saw that this year. The Black Bay 58 GMT is something that I would have probably immediately bought if it had the,
you know, styling of the Black Bay GMT with the Pepsi bezel, and, you know, or even if they had done the white dial version of that, you know, but the gilt and everything like that, I think turned a good number of people off of that watch. And sometimes that feels like what they're trying to do. You know, making sure that people think long and hard about what they want, whether it's, you know, do you actually want the Rolex, or are we going to give you a budget of something, that budget pick of something that's going to compete with that? I think, you know, I heard the feedback from the FXD GMT. I don't really, again, I don't necessarily see that as Fotina. I see that as a design choice. But I also see a world in which, like, if that was just a black watch with a lot less color and stuff, it would have been a much more massive hit with people. So if I was, you know, in charge of Tudor, which would probably make me, I don't understand their corporate structure, but it would probably make me in charge of Rolex as well. So I guess it's a cop out, but I don't want to use the word confidence, because I think they're doing a lot of really bold things, and confidence makes it sound like they're not, but like, have the confidence to say, like, look, we're not going to be competing necessarily for the same market share. And so if I'm doing a budget version and I'm giving people exactly what we want, we are doing the best thing for our customers who probably aren't going to be buying a Rolex every day anyway. I think the overlap is not as big as they are afraid it will be.
Okay.
So that would be my pick for Tudor.
All right. Rich, you feel any differently? A different strategy in your mind?
I actually feel quite similarly. Tudor does annoy me with their use of color and Fotina, and on products that, if used in a much more toned down color palette, would be better products almost like unanimously. And I think that gets into the Rolex not wanting to compete with Rolex thing, and wanting to give people an option that's lower price point and has a bit more color, is more of a unique sort of motif, I guess it would be. But Mark's thoughts actually brought me back to a vintage story that I've heard. When Rolex switched from hollow folded end link oysters to solid end link oysters, they updated the Tudor Submariner as well, which at that time was the same watch, just with a ETA movement, and it was all black. You know, there was much more similarities between Tudor and Rolex at that point than there are now. But they updated the Tudor Oyster to be solid link as well, and they saw a decrease in Rolex Submariner sales. I mean, this is of course just a story, I don't know the actual numbers, but you do see, as you move further into the 90s, they actually revert Tudor back to a folded link oyster to make it feel cheaper and to sort of drive more people towards the Submariner from Rolex. Sure. Which I think gets into a lot of the psychology of what Tudor and Rolex mean to that larger brand or foundation, however definitely it's set up now.
Yeah, definitely at the time. I think that philosophy, right. I think that the connection between the two brands is quite different than it was 20 years ago.
But I guess,
you know, following the relaunch in the US.
To sort of tie up that point, I think Tudor and Rolex are more split now than they were ever in terms of where they're thought of in the market. I think when somebody's new and into watches, they might say, oh yeah, Tudor is the sister brand of Rolex, and that's why people sort of start to get interested. But I think their customer bases are so different now that Tudor could do more to release products in more Rolex-y colors, like the Black Bay monochrome, and not be so afraid of stealing market share from Rolex, which is just not happening. Like, if you look at the colors Rolex uses, which are very, very toned down, very mass market, the Pepsi and the Batman and the Sprite. I mean, the Sprite feels crazy, even. It's just green, you know? Like, I think Tudor could use some of those more mass market colors and be more successful while also not stealing any, you know, market share from Rolex.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree. If I was put in charge, I would say, let's just try and do a couple more really conventional watches. You know, I think they have such a strong lineup of options. And then even though that's strong and it's, you know, they garner a huge amount of attention in the industry and the rest of it, then they launch something like the what we all call the monochrome, the 2024 41 millimeter Black Bay, and you just go like, yeah, but this is the one. Like, it took them however many years, 12 years or whatever, to kind of dig into that, and I think they just made a great thing, and I would love them to take that formula and apply it to the GMT and apply it to the 58 in general and the 54 and all this sort of stuff, and just kind of keep iterating in that space. And, you know, hopefully we continue to see some cool kind of avant-garde thinking in the FXD space. I think it's like the FXD being a sub brand of the Pelagos gives them some room to play around, whether it's a, you know, cycling chronograph or something as wild as like the proper FXD GMT and that sort of thing. So I think there's lots of good on the horizon for them, and I'm excited to see it. And I mean, obviously we can parlay this right into Rolex. We've got a handful of brands. So I'm going to say, you got two or three sentences. What would you do with Rolex this year?
Mark, Daytona, single tone, subdials?
No. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's for me, that would be it. I mean, look, they only did one steel sports watch last year at Watches and Wonders, which I think really people didn't process. Yeah. Steel Daytona, like the Le Mans with the single tone sub dials, is basically, I think, everything that anybody's been asking for. I don't care about the lollipop indices on the sub dials or any of that. I don't need the red on the bezel. Just give a classic looking Daytona back to the market. And I mean, Rolex is printing money already, so I guess I could say they'll be printing even more money, but that would be it for me. So thanks, Rich.
Yeah, I think there's a few small tweaks that Rolex could make to already existing products, like the Submariner. I just think of it because Jeff Hilliard is always complaining about the clasp on his new Submariner in the office. Rolex like still leans into wanting to create a professional product for this imagined consumer that's diving deep with their watches, or doing the exact thing that you're supposed to be doing with their professional models, which is the reason why that clasp is so big and long, because of dive extensions and wanting to, you know, feel like a very stout product for that honestly imaginary consumer. I'm sure people are diving.
Yeah, there's a handful for sure, but it's not to the extent that the Submariner is made. That's two very different numbers.
I don't think you lose much of that consumer or that wearer and like big part of your brand identity by making the small tweaks to make a watch like the Submariner a bit more comfortable for everyday life. And I think that sort of thinking can be trickled down throughout their whole catalog for those professional models. Like, hey guys, we don't have to be so professional anymore. You're making a watch that's, I think, mass market for the most part, and debatably luxury according to some of our team members, but yeah, I think that is long gone for Rolex, you know, and they're not making a watch for scuba divers anymore. And they could do a few small tweaks.
I would also say, like, within the world of Rolex's lineup, they also have the pro diver in the Sea Dweller. So I think they would have room to actually make the sub a little bit more cushy, if you will. I would love to see what the next eventual evolution of the Explorer 2 is. You know, we haven't seen a new, you know, like a fully new take on that model in quite some time. But I'm not playing the guessing game. We'll get to that in, you know, March or whatever, when we run that story with all the Photoshops. But I think it's an exciting time. You know, with you guys on the call, I would love also, like, again, try and keep it tight so we can get to a handful of these. But what about Patek? Is there something you would just, maybe we go this route? Doesn't have to be the CEO thing. What's just something you would love to see from Patek, you know, in a recent video that Ben did for the UBS thing? He spoke about wanting a really genuinely high-end take on a time-only Patek, something with the finishing from the higher level models and in a very tech forward movement and that sort of thing. Is that, would you guys just pair it? Like, is that something that's kind of universally felt among Patek's fan base?
I would just say simplify for Patek. Like, that's all they really need to do is, they have for a brand that makes so few watches in a year, they have a lot of models. They could simplify, you know, also simplifies maybe some of where they're drawing inspiration from in their history. And, you know, look, if I could have anything, if I could do like a slightly smaller QP chronograph with like a V-shaped case, you know, that's not it's a complex movement, but it's not a very complex demand. Forget like triple step cases or whatever, but just like simplify and give sort of a little bit more of a classic taste and
sure
a little bit less, you know.
What do you think, Rich?
Yeah, I think Ben's call out is basically he wants Patek to make a retchup or something on that level. Yeah. I would want a similar looking and feeling product, but at the other end of the pricing spectrum, I'd love to see Patek come out with a viable less than 38, 39 millimeter Calatrava that you could enter the brand with. They just don't have that product right now. They don't have the entry level, this is what Patek is, time only watch, which I think is desperately needed.
Okay, cool. I agree with those for sure. What about Cartier? I know certainly, Rich, you just did a great story for the magazine, Volume 13, reference points on the Tank LC. What would you love to see from, you know, we had a party at Cartier last year. We were all in the room. It was a very busy day and they had a lot of watches. What would you guys love to see, you know, come March, April from Cartier?
Cartier does a lot of what I would already want to see, to be honest. I think of modern brands, they respect their heritage, maybe the best. That being said, they respect their heritage the best at the high price point CPCP stuff. I would like to see that level of thinking and that level of care and honestly, sizing and like case thickness. The effort that they put towards that CPCP level product is for the consumer like me, who is really knowledgeable about their history and understands how those vintage and even from the 90s cases feel and how they wear on your wrist. I'd like to see that trickle down to the more commercial product, like a Centre that you don't have to spend 80 grand to buy would be amazing.
Mark, what do you figure for Cartier?
That's about what I would say. I think, again, like they do a lot of really respectful things with their heritage. Every year they come out with something really interesting. I think it was the Cousin that was like the watch that you could press and it would move. And, you know,
that was kind of a scary thing to witness in person, this like cushion watch. That you could compress the case.
It's a pillow and you can push on it, but it's set with diamonds and stuff.
Like the most expensive Tide Pod I've ever held. This is terrifying.
You know, then they do their, you know, Rewind this year, which I think a lot of people thought that they were crazy for came out.
It's a crazy idea.
And now it's like in a lot of people's picks for, you know, I think GQ mentioned it as one of the best watches of the year. I think a lot of people have come around to it as a crazy idea. I think that kind of thing, but maybe make it slightly less limited, slightly more accessible. Okay. I also like, this is a really random thing and maybe they're doing it for like high end clients and I don't know, but bring back the like super wild 1920s Cartier mystery clocks. I don't know who wants them.
Okay.
I don't know like who wants to spend $1 million on a jade mystery clock, but I want to see that like sitting in the center of the Watches and Wonders display and just be like, okay, cool. They just brought back this thing that people are going crazy for on the auction market, and I think they're very aware of what the market is doing, so it would be kind of fun to see.
Absolutely.
Oh, I got one more for Cartier. Sapphire or blue cabochons on white metal cases. I just do not like the ruby or red cabochons on platinum watches.
All right, interesting. Well, there you go. So a few tips for Cartier there. Look, the next one is one that I think it's a whole different ball game than what we've been talking about, but what about with Swatch? Arguably the impression brand on the internet of the last couple of years, thanks to Moonswatch, and then in some ways also Scuba 50 downstream of that. What would you guys love to see from Swatch? I talked about this with Malaika and Tantan, and they had some ideas for watches they would love to see be Swatchified, like in the same metric as the Moonswatch and the Scuba 50. If we're even dreaming outside of the realm of the Swatch group, what brand do you think would offer a really fun platform for that sort of exploration and that sort of move to bring a brand that we would know as watch nerds down to a level where a lot more people might be interested in experiencing it and lining up for the product and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I don't know about like doing a Moonswatch related collab or something like that, but I know that they've put some online. I'd like to see them start putting more of these releases online for people. I think, you know, now that they've slowed down past the Moonshine releases being so frequent, I think the pace is pretty good. I don't know. What I'd like to see is more options just in their general lineup. I know they have a ton of watches out there. But I went into a Swatch store with my mom actually a couple weeks ago and was looking for something that might fit her. And just like there weren't enough smaller options. There weren't enough things that really did anything for her. I was gonna buy her one just as a fun gift and a couple more options, a couple more fun things, a couple more simple things, just continue expanding the lineup now that you've got the eyeballs on the brand. And again, like look, they know what they're doing with the Moonswatch thing. James, you've said it. Like, people ask us to stop covering it. We'll stop covering it when they
stop reading it.
You know, the amount of clicks, and it's not all about the clicks, but that does show that there is a level of interest when that stuff comes out.
Absolutely.
So who am I to say that we shouldn't cover that?
Rich, what do you figure?
Yeah, on the collaboration question, I'm still trying to think, but I don't know why this one popped to mind, but they've done a chronograph, they've done a dive watch. I'd like to see something a bit more interesting on the dress side, like a dressy swatch collaboration. I think it would be cool. I don't think it would be nearly as popular as something like a moon swatch. And but like, I don't know why this one, obviously it's in the group, but I actually really like Harry Winston's aesthetic, the case that mimics the front doors of their, I think it's their flagship boutique. I'm not sure. I don't even know what they call the name or this case these days, but it's very like architectural. And I think they might sell 4 and 3 to me, but doing a moon or a swatch collab with Harry Winston in that case, I think would be really cool. Actually,
a Harry swatch.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got a ring to it.
Yeah. And it's a totally different product than what we're thinking of probably, but
I think it's a fascinating thing to kind of dream about other brands that this could, that I think it could work on. I think the craziest one in my mind would be Richard Mille, like a swatch Richard Mille, something that captured the case shape and the architecture, but rendered it not in, you know, nanotubes and TPTs, but rather in bioceramic. You know, obviously the issue, there's some issue there with, to really replicate a Richard Mille, you usually have some insane complication or technical sign of evolution or even just like skeletonization. So some of that could be kind of difficult, but I do kind of like dream of that. I think Hublot would be an interesting partner for them as well. Like to do a little big bang or even something more wild, something in, like in a little bit more of a conceptual space could be really fun. I don't think the idea is going away. I think this would be a crazy time for them to like go, we did enough. It's all good. I think we'll see more Speedies. I don't know if we'll see more Blancpain. But I'd be surprised if we didn't see more Speedies down the road from them. And I agree with Mark. The thing that I would be changing if I was in charge would be, I get like if you just launched the brand new one and it's for a specific color of the moon. Sure, yeah, it's store only for the first month, or it's store only and they sell them out and you don't have to put them online. But with anything that's not limited, like just sell it online, let people buy them.
I had one last idea with this watch thing, and I thought about it because I have this watch from a retailer in Japan, and I think it's something that they could maybe do. But you know, you said they've done other complications. What about a like push button minute repeater swatch? You know, get somebody to make. I have a quartz minute repeater.
It's so cool.
And
what's the brand? Literally, just
it's Shellman. It is Shellman, retailer. Okay. Yeah, Shellman in Japan.
We'll put it in the show notes. Cool. You guys have to see this thing. Jaw dropped for not that much money when you showed it to me.
Yeah, I mean they're harder and harder to find because they were made in the, I think in the 90s, late 90s maybe, but you know, it's a Miyota movement, it's a quartz movement, and it's a digital chime, so it has that digital like almost 8-bit quality, but it kind of replicates
when you leave the door open on your Chevy Lumina.
So why not do that if you're Swatch? Like, I'm sure it would maybe be a $500 watch, but I'm sure they could figure out a way to make a, you know, a beeping sound out of a watch. And then all of a sudden they've got some sort of a minute repeater.
I mean, that's a really fascinating idea because it kind of takes the moon swatch idea and flips it on its head, where they're taking an iconic design and like a cultural element and making it a swatch. And with this, imagine if it was a Blancpain or a Breguet or something like that, where you could really tap into the structure of some very traditional watchmaking and introduce that as the platform for new enthusiasts. I think that could be, that's cool. I like that idea. Look, we are running the clock though, so I just wanted to leave it up for the last 5 minutes or whatever we've got. Anything else you guys are like looking forward to next year? Something you're excited about? I'm kind of like, I'm stressed about it, to be fair, but I'm also kind of excited to see what Watch and Wonders is going to be like after last year. I think it's going to be, I'm expecting some fireworks, would be my guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were sort of told going into Watches and Wonders last year that this year was going to be kind of tame.
Yeah,
which,
build year, whatever.
Yeah, and it was, you know, people holding back 2025, nice round number, you get something interesting coming out. I think that's fine. until the, you know, it's like you put off a deadline and all of a sudden, you know, you have 14 assignments that are due at the same time. Like, it's kind of exciting to see, and you hope that it's going to happen. But now I'm a little stressed about, you know, if you've got 12 brands that are going to have the biggest year, you've got an anniversary for Vacheron, 270th, you've got an anniversary for AP. So there, I think there's going to be a lot going on. The other thing is when you say stuff like that, it does push the expectations up a little bit.
For sure.
You know, and so it's very possible that, like, it could be, you could walk into Watches and Wonders and have the like Christmas Day sort of situation where you open the package and you're like, oh, socks, you know, like, you know, you got really excited. You told people what you wanted and that's what you got, which I've started to reach the point in my life where socks aren't a terrible gift, but
socks are a great gift.
But
if you're expecting a yak back, socks are tough, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
The only one on this call old enough for the yak back. Understood. Okay, fine. So Rich, how about you? Any final thoughts for 2025?
I'm just thinking about my sort of what I called 2024, which was the year of the shaped watch. I think 2025 might be the year of we're tired of the shaped watch.
Enough shapes.
I'm just thinking of the actual buyer and someone who's interested in something like that is pretty thin. And I sort of hesitate with especially the larger brands. If there's shaped watches on the floor at Watches and Wonders, I think we're in trouble.
What sort of trouble?
I think people will just get tired of that trend and revert back to round and like more standard designs pretty quickly. I'm not calling it because I think there's something else going on with the crash market, but if you look at the way the crash has sort of trended downwards, it's telling me that the buyer for things like that at the highest level is not a very wide market. So I think if micro brands continue to go into that space and look into different shapes, although I'm all for it, I'll love them every time. I think sort of the mass watch world might sort of flinch if brands and smaller brands continue to enter into this shaped, like interesting design led markets.
Nice. Yeah, good feedback and a good thought. I had the shaped trend on the list and we didn't quite get to it. That's how these pods go. I'm sure we'll have lots of fresh conversations in the new year, but I wanted to thank both you guys for coming on and closing out 2024 with me.
Popping champagne now? Is this how it's going?
Let's do it. Yeah. I don't, this will probably run like right around New Year's. So somebody will be getting some champagne for sure.
I should have had like sparklers or something ready for the,
yeah. You guys didn't bring caviar and champagne.
We'll put all that in digitally. It'll be okay. We'll use the AI. It'll be fine. But yeah, thank you so much for listening and to you guys for coming on the show. And if you're listening and want to get in on the conversation about what you think 2025 is going to be like, what your favorite parts of 2024 were, major watches, releases you're hoping to see next year, the rest of it, hit the show notes and you'll find the comments just below that on hoodinky.com and certainly a great conversation over on YouTube as well. So thanks so much for listening this year and we'll be back in early 2025 with more. Take care.